because whenever he finished the last of the substances on hand, he always threw out all his bongs and pipes, screens and tubes and rolling papers and roach clips, lighters and Visine and Pepto-Bismol, and cookies and frosting to eliminate all future temptation. He always felt a sense of optimism and firm resolve after he'd discarded the materials. He'd bought the new bong and laid in fresh supplies this morning, getting back home with everything well before the woman had said she would come. He thought of the new bong, a new little packet of round brass screens in the Bogart's bag on his kitchen table in the sunlit kitchen, and could not remember what color the new bong was. The last one had been orange. The one before that, a dusky rose color that had turned muddy at the bottom from resin in just 4 days. He could not remember the color of this new last and final bong. He considered getting up to check the color of the bong he'd be using, but decided that obsessive checking and convulsive movements could compromise the atmosphere of casual calm he needed to maintain while he waited, protruding, but not moving, for the woman he'd met at a design session for his agency's small campaign for her small theater company's new Vedicant Festival, while he waited for this woman, with whom he'd had intercourse twice, to honor her casual promise. He tried to decide whether the woman was pretty. Another thing he'd laid in when he'd committed himself to one last marijuana vacation was petroleum jelly. When he smoked marijuana, he tended to masturbate a great deal, whether or not there were opportunities for intercourse, opting when he smoked for masturbation over intercourse, and the petroleum jelly kept him from returning to normal function, all tender and sore. He was also hesitant to get up and check the color of his bong because he would have to pass right by the telephone console to get to the kitchen, and he didn't want to be tempted to call the woman who said she would come again because he felt creepy about bothering her about something he'd represented as so casual, and was afraid that several audio hang-ups on her answering device would look even creepier. And also he felt anxious about tying up the line at just the moment when she called, as she certainly would. He decided to get call waiting added to his audiophone service for a nominal extra charge. Then remembered that since this was positively the last time he would or even could indulge what Randy with an I had called an addiction, every bit as rapacious as pure alcoholism, there would be no real need for call waiting, since a situation like the present one could never arise again. This line of thinking almost caused him to become angry. To ensure the composure with which he sat waiting in light in his chair, he focused his senses on his surroundings. No part of the insect he'd seen was now visible. The clicks of his portable clock were really composed of three smaller clicks, signifying, he supposed, preparation, movement, and readjustment. He began to grow disgusted with himself for waiting so anxiously for the promised arrival of something that had stopped being fun anyway. He didn't even know why he liked it anymore. It made his mouth dry and his eyes dry and red and his face sag, and he hated it when his face sagged. It was as if all the integrity of all the muscles in his face was eroded by marijuana, and he got terribly self-conscious about the fact that his face was sagging and had long ago forbidden himself to smoke dope around anyone else. He didn't even know what its draw was anymore. He couldn't even be around anyone else if he'd smoked marijuana that same day. It made him so self-conscious. And the dope often gave him a painful case of pleurisy if he smoked it for more than 2 straight days of heavy, continuous smoking in front of the interlaced viewer in his bedroom. It made his thoughts jut out crazily in jagged directions and made him stare raptly like an unbright child at entertainment cartridges. When he laid in film cartridges for a vacation with marijuana, he favored cartridges in which a lot of things blew up and crashed into each other, which he was sure an unpleasant fact specialist like Randy would point out had implications that were not good. He pulled his necktie down smooth while he gathered his intellect, will, self-knowledge, and conviction, and determined that when this latest woman came, as she surely would, This would simply be his very last marijuana debauch. He'd simply smoke so much, so fast, that it would be so unpleasant, and the memory of it so repulsive, that once he'd consumed it and gotten it out of his home and his life as quickly as possible, he would never want to do it again. He would make it his business to create a really bad set of debauched associations with the stuff in his memory. The dope scared him. It made him afraid. It wasn't that he was afraid of the dope, it was that smoking it made him afraid of everything else. It had long since stopped being a release, or relief, or fun. This last time, he would smoke the whole 200 grams, 120 grams cleaned, destemmed, in 4 days, over an ounce a day, all in tight, heavy, economical one-hitters off a quality virgin bong, an incredible, insane amount per day. He'd make it a mission, treating it like a penance and behavior modification regimen all at once. He'd smoke his way through 30 high-grade grams a day, starting the moment he woke up and used ice water to detach his tongue from the roof of his mouth and took an antacid, averaging out to 200 or 300 heavy bong hits per day, an insane and deliberately unpleasant amount, and he'd make it a mission to smoke it continuously, even though if the marijuana was as good as the woman claimed, he'd do 5 hits and then not want to take the trouble to load and one hit anymore for at least an hour. But he would force himself to do it anyway. He would smoke it all, even if he didn't want it. Even if it started to make him dizzy and ill, he would use discipline and persistence and will and make the whole experience so unpleasant, so debased and debauched and unpleasant that his behavior would be henceforward modified. He'd never even want to do it again because the memory of the insane 4 days to come would be so firmly, terribly emblazoned in his memory. He'd cure himself by excess. He predicted that the woman, when she came, might want to smoke some of the 200 grams with him, hang out, hole up, listen to some of his impressive collection of Tito Puente recordings, and probably have intercourse. He had never once had actual intercourse on marijuana. Frankly, the idea repelled him. 2 dry mouths bumping at each other, trying to kiss, his self-conscious thoughts twisting around on themselves like a snake on a stick, while he bucked and snorted dryly above her, his swollen eyes red and his face sagging so that its slack folds may be touched, limply, the folds of her own loose sagging face as it sloshed back and forth on his pillow, its mouth working dryly. The thought was repellent. He decided he'd have her toss him what she'd promised to bring, and then would from a distance toss back to her the $1,250 U.S. in large bills and tell her not to let the door hit her on the butt on the way out. He'd say ass instead of butt. He'd be so rude and unpleasant to her that the memory of his lack of basic decency and of her tight, offended face would be a further disincentive ever in the future to risk calling her and repeating the course of action he had now committed himself to. He had never been so anxious for the arrival of a woman he did not want to see. He remembered clearly the last woman he'd involved in his trying just one more vacation with dope and drawn blinds. The last woman had been something called an appropriation artist, which seemed to mean that she copied and embellished other art and then sold it through a prestigious Marlboro Street gallery. She had an artistic manifesto that involved radical feminist themes. He'd let her give him one of her smaller paintings, which covered half the wall over his bed, and was of a famous film actress whose name he always had a hard time recalling, and a less famous film actor, the two of them entwined in a scene from a well-known old film, a romantic scene, an embrace, copied from a film history textbook, and much enlarged and made stilted, and with obscenities scrawled all over it in bright red letters.
One.
The last woman had been sexy but not pretty, as the woman he now didn't want to see but was still waiting anxiously for was pretty in a faded, withered Cambridge way that made her seem pretty but not sexy. The appropriation artist had been led to believe that he was a former speed addict, intravenous addiction to methamphetamine hydrochloride, is what he remembered telling that one. He had even described the awful taste of hydrochloride in the addict's mouth immediately after injection. He had researched the subject carefully. She had been further led to believe that marijuana kept him from using the drug with which he really had a problem, and so that if he seemed anxious to get some once she'd offered to get him some, it was only because he was heroically holding out against much darker, deeper, more addictive urges, and he needed her to help him. He couldn't quite remember when or how she'd been given all these impressions. He had not sat down and outright bold-faced lied to her. It had been more of an impression he'd conveyed and nurtured and allowed to gather its own life and force. The insect was now entirely visible. It was on the shelf that held his digital equalizer. The insect might never actually have retreated all the way back into the hole in the shelf's girder. What looked like its reemergence might just have been a change in his attention, or the two windows' light, or the visual context of his surroundings. The girder protruded from the wall and was a triangle of dull steel with holes for shelves to fit into. The metal shelves that held his audio equipment were painted a dark industrial green and were originally made for holding canned goods. They were designed to be extra kitchen shelves. The insect sat inside its dark, shiny case with an immobility that seemed like the gathering of a force. It sat like the hull of a vehicle from which the engine had been, for the moment, removed. It was dark and had a shiny case and antennae that protruded but did not move. He had to use a bathroom. His last piece of contact from the appropriation artist, with whom he had had intercourse, and who during intercourse had sprayed some sort of perfume up into the air from a mister she held in her left hand as she lay beneath him, making a wide variety of sounds and spraying perfume up into the air, so that he felt the cold mist of it settling on his back and shoulders and was chilled and repelled. His last piece of contact after he'd gone into hiding with the marijuana she'd gotten for him had been a card she'd mailed that was a pastiche photo of a doormat of coarse green plastic grass with "Welcome" on it, and next to it, a flattering publicity photo of the appropriation artist from her Back Bay gallery, and between them, an unequal sign, which was an equal sign with a diagonal slash across it, and also an obscenity he had assumed was directed at him, majusculed in red grease pencil along the bottom, with multiple exclamation points. She had been offended, because he had seen her every day for 10 days. Then, when she'd finally obtained 50 grams of genetically enhanced hydroponic marijuana for him, he had said that she'd saved his life, and he was grateful, and the friends for whom he'd promised to get some were grateful. And she had to go right now because he had an appointment and had to take off, but that he would doubtless be calling her later that day. And they shared a moist kiss, and she had said she could feel his heart pounding right through his suit coat. And she had driven away in her rusty, unmuffled car, and he had gone and moved his own car to an underground garage several blocks away, and had run back and drawn the clean blinds and curtains, and changed the audio message on his answering device to one that described an emergency departure from town, and had drawn and locked his bedroom blinds, and had taken the new rose-colored bong out of its Bogart's bag, and was not seen for 3 days. And ignored over 24 audio messages and protocols and e-notes expressing concern over his message's emergency, and had never contacted her again. He had hoped she would assume he had succumbed again to methamphetamine hydrochloride and was sparing her the agony of his descent back into the hell of chemical dependence. What it really was that he had again decided those 50 grams of resin-soaked dope which had been so potent that on the second day it had given him an anxiety attack so paralyzing that he had gone to the bathroom in a Tufts University commemorative ceramic stein to avoid leaving his bedroom, represented his very last debauch ever with dope, and that he had to cut himself off from all possible future sources of temptation and supply. And this surely included the appropriation artist, who would come with the stuff at precisely the time she'd promised, he recalled. From the street outside came the sound of a dumpster being emptied into an EWD land barge. His shame at what she might, on the other hand, perceive as his slimy, phallocentric conduct toward her made it easier for him to avoid her as well. Though not shame, really. More like being uncomfortable at the thought of it. He had had to launder his bedding twice to get the smell of the perfume out. He went into the bathroom to use the bathroom, making it a point to look neither at the insect visible on the shelf to his left, nor at the telephone console on its lacquer workstation to the right. He was committed to touching neither. Where was the woman who had said she'd come? The new bong in the Bogart's bag was orange, meaning he might have misremembered the bong before it as orange. It was a rich, autumnal orange that lightened to more of a citrus orange when its plastic cylinder was held up to the late afternoon light of the window over the kitchen sink. The metal of its stem and bowl was rough, stainless steel, the kind with a grain, unpretty and all business. The bong was half a meter tall and had a weighted base covered in soft, false suede. Its orange plastic was thick, and the carb on the side opposite the stem had been raggedly cut so that rough shards of plastic protruded from the little hole, and it might well hurt his thumb when he smoked, which he decided to consider just part of the penance he would undertake after the woman had come and gone. He left the door to the bathroom open so that he would be sure to hear the telephone when it sounded or the buzzer to the front doors of his condominium complex when it sounded. In the bathroom, his throat suddenly closed and he wept hard for 2 or 3 seconds before the weeping stopped abruptly, and he could not get it to start again. It was now over 4 hours since the time the woman had casually committed to come. He was in the bathroom or in his chair near the window or near his telephone console and the insect and the window that had admitted a strange rectangular bar of light when he began to wait. The light through this window was coming at an angle more and more oblique. Its shadow had become a parallelogram. The light through the southwest window was straight and reddening. He had thought he needed to use the bathroom, but was unable to. He tried putting a whole stack of film cartridges into the dock of the disk drive and then turning on the huge teleputer in his bedroom. He could see the piece of appropriation art in the mirror above the teepee. He lowered the volume all the way and pointed the remote device at the teepee like some sort of weapon. He sat on the edge of his bed with his elbows on his knees and scanned the stack of cartridges. Each cartridge in the dock dropped on command and began to engage the drive with an insectile click and whir, and he scanned it. But he was unable to distract himself with the TP because he was unable to stay with any one entertainment cartridge for more than a few seconds. The moment he recognized what exactly was on one cartridge, he had a strong anxious feeling that there was something more entertaining on another cartridge and that he was potentially missing it. He realized that he would have plenty of time to enjoy all the cartridges, and realized, intellectually, that the feeling of deprived panic over missing something made no sense. The viewer hung on the wall, half again as large as the piece of feminist art. He scanned cartridges for some time. The telephone console sounded during this interval of anxious scanning. He was up and moving back out toward it before the first ring was completed, flooded with either excitement or relief. The TP's remote device still in his hand, but it was only a friend and colleague calling. And when he heard the voice that was not the woman who had promised to bring what he'd committed the next several days to banishing from his life forever, he was almost sick with disappointment. With a great deal of mistaken adrenaline now shining and ringing in his system, and he got off the line with the colleague to clear the line and keep it available for the woman so fast that he was sure his colleague perceived him as either angry with him or just plain rude. He was further upset at the thought that his answering the telephone this late in the day did not jibe with the emergency message about being unreachable that would be on his answering device if the colleague called back after the woman had come and gone and he'd shut the whole system of his life down, and he was standing over the telephone console trying to decide whether the risk of the colleague or someone else from the agency calling back was sufficient to justify changing the audio message on the answering device to describe an emergency departure this evening instead of this afternoon. But he decided he felt that since the woman had definitely committed to coming, his leaving the message unchanged would be a gesture of fidelity to her commitment and might somehow, in some oblique way, strengthen that commitment. The EWD land barge was emptying dumpsters all up and down the street. He returned to his chair near the window. The disk drive and TP viewer were still on in his bedroom, and he could see through the angle of the bedroom's doorway the lights from the high-definition screen blink and shift from one primary color to another in the dim room. And for a while he killed time casually by trying to imagine what entertaining scenes on the unwatched viewer the changing colors and intensities might signify. The chair faced the room instead of the window. Reading while waiting for marijuana was out of the question. He considered masturbating, but did not. He didn't reject the idea so much as not react to it and watch as it floated away. He thought very broadly of desires and ideas being watched, but not acted upon. He thought of impulses being starved of expression and drying out and floating dryly away, and felt on some level that this had something to do with him and his circumstances. And what if this grueling final debauch he committed himself to didn't somehow resolve the problem, would surely have to be called his problem. But he could not even begin to try to see how the image of desiccated impulses floating dryly related to either him or the insect, which had retreated back into its hole in the angled girder, because at this precise time, his telephone and his intercom to the front door's buzzer both sounded at the same time. Both loud and tortured and so abrupt they sounded yanked through a very small hole into the great balloon of colored silence he sat in, waiting. And he moved first toward the telephone console, then over toward his intercom module, then convulsively back toward the sounding phone, and then tried somehow to move toward both at once, finally, so that he stood splay-legged, arms wildly out as if something's been flung, splayed, entombed between the two sounds, without a thought in his head. The 1st of April, year of the Tux medicated pad.
All I know is my dad said to come here.
Come right in. You'll see a chair to your immediate left.
So, I'm here.
That's just fine. 7-Up? Maybe some lemon soda?
I guess not, thanks. I'm just here is all, and I'm kind of wondering why my dad sent me down, you know? Your door there doesn't have anything on it, and I was just at the dentist last week, and so I'm wondering why I'm here exactly is all. That's why I'm not sitting down yet.
You're how old, Hal? 14?
I'll be 11 in June. Are you a dentist? Is this like a dental consult?
You're here to converse.
Converse?
Yes. Pardon me while I key in this age correction. Your father had listed you as 14 for some reason.
Converse as in with you?
You're here to converse with me, Hal, yes. I'm almost going to have to implore you to have some lemon soda. Your mouth is making those dry, sticky, inadequate saliva sounds.
Dr. Zagarelli says that's one reason for all the caries, is that I have low salivary output.
Those dry, sticky, salivaless sounds which can be death to a good conversation.
But I rode my bike all the way up here against the wind just to converse with you? Is the conversation supposed to start with me asking why?
I'll begin by asking if you know the meaning of implore, Hal.
Probably. I'll go ahead and take a 7-Up then if you're going to implore. I'll ask you again whether you know Implore, young sir.
Young sir?
You're wearing that bow tie, after all. Isn't that rather an invitation to a young sir?
Implore is a regular verb, transitive. To call upon or for in supplication. To pray to or for earnestly. To beseech, to entreat. Weak synonym, urge. Strong synonym, beg. Etymology unmixed. From Latin, implorare. Im, meaning in. Plorare, meaning in this context, to cry aloud.
OED, Condensed Volume 6, page 1387, column 12, and a little bit of 13.
Good Lord. She didn't exaggerate, did she?
I tend to get beat up sometimes at the academy for stuff like that. Does this bear on why I'm here? That I'm a continentally ranked junior tennis player who can also recite great chunks of the dictionary, verbatim, at will, and tends to get beat up, and wears a bow tie? Are you like a specialist for gifted kids? Does this mean they think I'm gifted?
Psst. Here you are, drink up.
Thanks.
You were thirsty.
So then if I sit down, you'll fill me in?
Professional conversationalist knows his mucous membranes, after all.
I might have to burp a little bit in a second from the soda. I'm alerting you ahead of time.
Hal, you are here because I am a professional conversationalist, and your father has made an appointment with me for you to converse.
Oh, excuse me. Tap, 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 tap. Tap, 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 tap. You're a professional conversationalist.
I am, yes, as I believe I just stated, a professional conversationalist.
Don't start looking at your watch, as if I'm taking up valuable time of yours. If himself made the appointment and paid for it, the time's supposed to be mine, right? Not yours. And then, but what's that supposed to mean, professional conversationalist? A conversationalist is just one who converses much. You actually charge a fee to converse much?
A conversationalist is also one who, I'm sure you'll recall, excels in conversation.
That's Webster 7th. It's not the OED.
Tap, tap.
I'm an OED man, doctor.
If that's what you are.
Are you a doctor? Do you have a doctorate? Most people like to put their diplomas up, I notice, if they have credentials. And Webster 7th isn't even up to date. Webster's 8th amends to one who converses with much enthusiasm.
Another 7 up?
Is himself still having this hallucination I never speak? Is that why he put the moms up to having me bike up here? Himself is my dad. We call him himself. As in, quote, the man himself. As it were, we call my mother the moms. My brother coined the term. I understand this isn't unusual. I understand most more or less normal families address each other internally by means of pet names and terms and monikers. Don't even think about asking me what my little internal moniker is.
Tap, tap, tap.
But himself hallucinates sometimes lately. You ought to be apprised, was the thrust. I'm wondering why the moms let him send me pedaling up here, uphill against the wind, when I've got a challenge match at 3 to converse with an enthusiast with a blank door and no diplomas anywhere in view.
I, in my small way, would like to think it had as much to do with me as with you, that my reputation preceded me.
Isn't that usually a pejorative clause?
I am wonderful fun to talk to. I'm a consummate professional. People leave my parlor in states. You are here. It's conversation time. Shall we discuss Byzantine erotica?
How did you know I was interested in Byzantine erotica?
You seem persistently to confuse me with someone who merely hangs out a shingle with the word conversationalist on it, and this operation with a fly-by-night one, strung together with chewing gum and twine. You think I have no support staff? Researchers at my beck? You think we don't delve full-born to the psyches of those for whom we've made appointments to converse?
You don't think this fully accredited, limited partnership would have an interest in obtaining data on what informs and stimulates our conversees?
I know only one person who'd ever use full bore in casual conversation.
There is nothing casual about a professional conversationalist and staff. We delve. We obtain. And then some, young sir.
Okay. Alexandrian or Constantinian?
You think we haven't thoroughly researched your own connection with the whole current intra-provincial crisis in southern Quebec?
What intra-provincial crisis in southern Quebec? I thought you wanted to talk racy mosaics.
This is an upscale district of a vital North American metropolis, Hal. Standards here are upscale and high. A professional conversationalist flat out full-bore delves. Do you for one moment think that a professional plier of the trade of conversation would fail to probe, beak deep into your family's sordid liaison with the Pan-Canadian Resistance's notorious Monsieur Duplessis and his malevolent but allegedly irresistible amanuensis, cum operative, Luria P?
Listen, are you okay?
Do you?
I'm 10 for Pete's sake. I think maybe your appointment calendar squares got juggled. I'm the potentially gifted 10-year-old tennis and lexical prodigy whose mom's a continental mover and shaker in the prescriptive grammar academic world, and whose dad's a towering figure in optical and avant-garde film circles, and single-handedly founded the Enfield Tennis Academy but drinks wild turkey at like 5 a.m. and pitches over sideways during dawn drills, on the court some days, and some days presents with delusions about people's mouths moving but nothing coming out. I'm not even up to J yet in the condensed OED, much less Quebec or malevolent Luria's.
Of the fact that photos of the aforementioned liaison being leaked to Der Spiegel resulted in the bizarre deaths of both an Ottawan paparazzo and a Bavarian international affairs editor, of an alpenstock through the abdomen and an ill-swallowed cocktail onion, respectively?
I just finished Jew's ear. I'm just starting on Jew's harp and the general theory of oral liars. I've never even skied.
That you could dare to imagine we'd fail conversationally to countenance certain weekly, shall we say, maternal assignations with a certain unnamed bisexual bassoonist in the Albertan Secret Guard's tactical bands unit?
Gee, is that the exit over there I see?
That your blithe inattention to your own dear grammatical mother's cavortings with not one, not two, but over 30 Near Eastern medical attachés?
Would it be rude to tell you your mustache is askew?
That her introduction of esoteric mnemonic steroids, stereochemically not dissimilar to your father's own daily hypodermic megavitamin supplement, derived from a certain organic testosterone regeneration compound, distilled by the Hevero shaman of the South Central LA Basin into your innocent-looking bowl of morning Ralston.
As a matter of fact, I'll go ahead and tell you your whole face is kind of running, sort of. If you want to check, your nose is pointing at your lap.
That your quote-unquote complimentary Dunlop wide-body tennis rackets, super-secret formulaic composition materials of high modulus, graphite-reinforced, polycarbonate, polybutylene resin, are organochemically identical, I say again, identical, to the gyroscopic balance sensor and the mise-en-scene appropriation card and priapistic entertainment cartridge implanted in your very own towering father's anaplastic cerebrum, after his cruel series of detoxifications and convolution smoothings and gastrectomy and prostatectomy and pancreatectomy and phallectomy?
Tap, tap.
Could possibly escape the combined investigation attention of...
And it strikes me I've definitely seen that Argyle sweater vest before. That's himself's special Interdependence Day celebratory dinner Argyle sweater vest that he makes a point of never having cleaned. I know those stains. I was there for that clot of veal marsala right there. Is this whole appointment a date-connected thing? Is this April Fool's dad? Or do I need to call the moms and CT?
It requires only daily evidence that you speak, that you recognize the occasional vista beyond your own generous mondragonoid nose's fleshy tip.
You rented a whole office and face for this, but leave your old unmistakable sweater vest on? And how'd you even get down here before me, with the mercury up on blocks after you... Did you fool CT into giving you the keys to a functional car?
Who used to pray daily for the day his own dear late father would sit, cough, open that bloody tissue of the Tucson citizen, and not turn that newspaper into the room's fifth wall? And who, after all this light and noise, has apparently spawned the same silence? Who's lived his whole ruddy, bloody, cruddy life in five-walled rooms?
Dad, I've got a duly scheduled challenge match with Schacht in 12 minutes. Wind at my back downhill or no. I've got this oral lyrologist who's going to be outside Brighton Best Savings wearing a pre-designated necktie at straight up 5. I have to mow his lawn for a month for this interview. I can't just sit here watching you think I'm mute while your fake nose points at the floor. And are you hearing me talking, Dad? It speaks. It accepts soda. And defines implore and converses with you.
Praying for just one conversation, amateur or no, that does not end in terror. That does not end like all the others. You staring, me swallowing. Son. Son.
The 9th of May, year of the Depend adult undergarment. Another way fathers impact sons is that sons, once their voices have changed in puberty, invariably answer the telephone with the same locutions and intonations as their fathers. This holds true regardless of whether the fathers are still alive. Because he left his dormitory room before 0600 for dawn drills, and often didn't get back there until after supper, packing his book bag and knapsack and gear bag for the whole day, together with selecting his best strung rackets, it all took Hal some time. Plus, he usually collected and packed and selected in the dark, and with stealth, because his brother Mario was usually still asleep in the other bed. Mario didn't drill, and couldn't play, and needed all the sleep he could get. Hal held his complimentary gear bag and was putting different pairs of sweats to his face, trying to find the cleanest pair by smell, when the telephone console sounded. Mario thrashed and sat up in bed, a small, hunched shape with a big head against the gray light of the window. Hal got to the console on the second ring and had the transparent phone's antenna out by the third. His way of answering the phone sounded like, yellow.
I want to tell you, the voice on the phone said. My head is filled with things to say.
Hal held three pairs of ETA sweatpants in the hand that didn't hold the phone. He saw his older brother succumb to gravity and fall back limp against the pillows. Mario often sat up and fell back, still asleep.
I don't mind, Hal said softly. I could wake forever.
That's what you think, the voice said.
The connection was cut. It had been Orin.
Hey, Hal.
The light in the room was a creepy gray, a kind of non-light. Hal could hear Brandt laughing at something Kenkel had said, off down the hall, on the clank of their janitorial buckets. The person on the phone had been O.
Hey, Hal.
Mario was awake. It took four pillows to support Mario's oversized skull. His voice came from the tangled bedding.
Is it still dark out, or is it me? Go back to sleep. It isn't even 6.
Hal put the good leg into the sweatpants first.
Who was it?
Shoving three coverless Dunlop wide bodies into the gear bag and zipping the bag partway up so the handles had room to stick out. Carrying all three bags back over to the console to deactivate the ringer on the phone, he said,
No one you know, I don't think.
Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Though only one half ethnic Arab and a Canadian by birth and residence, the medical attaché is nevertheless once again under Saudi diplomatic immunity, this time as special ear-nose-throat consultant to the personal physician of Prince Q, the Saudi Minister of Home Entertainment, here on northeastern USA soil, with his legation to cut another mammoth deal with Interlace Tel Entertainment.
The medical attaché turns 37 tomorrow, Thursday, the 2nd of April, in the North American lunar YDAU, year of the Depend adult undergarment. The legation finds the promotional subsidy of the North American calendar hilariously vulgar. To say nothing of the arresting image of the idolatrous West's most famous and self-congratulating idol, the colossal libertine statue, wearing some type of enormous adult design diaper, and hilariously apposite image popular in the news photos of so many international journals. The attaché's medical practice being normally divided between Montreal and the Rub Al-Khali, it is his first trip back to USA soil since completing his residency 8 years ago. His duties here involve migrating with the prince and his retinue between Interlace's two hubs of manufacture and dissemination in Phoenix, Arizona, USA, and Boston, Massachusetts, USA, respectively, offering expert ENT assistance to the personal physician of Prince Q. The medical attaché's particular expertise is the maxillofacial consequences of imbalances in intestinal flora. Prince Q, as would anyone who refuses to eat pretty much anything but Toblerone, suffers chronically from Candida albicans, with attendant susceptibilities to Manilial sinusitis and thrush, the yeasty sores and sinal impactions of which require almost daily drainage in the cold and damp of early spring Boston, USA. A veritable artist, possessed of a deftness nonpareil, with cotton swab and evacuation hypo, the medical attaché is known among the shrinking upper classes of Petro-Arab nations as the Debakey of maxillofacial yeast. His staggering fee scale is holy ad valorem. Saudi consulting fees in particular are somewhere just past obscene, but the medical attaché's duties on this trip are personally draining and sort of nauseous, and when he arrives back at the sumptuous apartments he had his wife sublet in districts far from the legation's normal Back Bay and Scottsdale digs, at the day's end, he needs unwinding in the very worst way. A more than averagely devout follower of the North American Sufism, promulgated in his childhood by Pir Valayat, the medical attaché partakes of neither kif nor distilled spirits, and must unwind without chemical aid. When he arrives home after evening prayers, he wants to look upon a spicy and 100% Sharia halal dinner, piping hot and arranged and steaming pleasantly on its attractive tray. He wants his bib ironed and laid out by the tray at the ready. And he wants the living room's telepewter booted and warmed up and the evening's entertainment cartridges already selected and arranged and lined up in dock, ready for remote insertion into the viewer's drive. He reclines before the viewer in his special electronic recliner, and his black-veiled, ethnically Arab wife wordlessly attends him, loosening any constrictive clothing, adjusting the room's lighting, fitting the complexly molded dinner tray over his head so that his shoulders support the tray and allow it to project into space just below his chin, that he may enjoy his hot dinner without having to remove his eyes from whatever entertainment is up and playing. He has a narrow imperial-style beard, which his wife also attends, and keeps free of detritus from the tray just below. The medical attaché sits and watches and eats and watches, unwinding by visible degrees, until the angles of his body in the chair and his head on his neck indicate that he has passed into sleep, at which point his special electronic recliner can be made automatically to recline to full horizontal, and luxuriant silk analog bedding emerges, flowing from long slots in the appliance's sides. And, unless his wife is inconsiderate and clumsy with the recliner's remote handheld controls, the medical attaché is permitted to ease effortlessly from unwound spectation into a fully relaxed night's sleep. Still right there in the recumbent recliner, the teepee set to run a recursive loop of low-volume surf and light rain on broad green leaves. Except
that is, for Wednesday nights, which in Boston are permitted to be his wife's Arab Women's Advanced League tennis night with the other legation wives and companions at the plush Mount Auburn Club in West Watertown, on which nights she is not around wordlessly to attend him, since Wednesday is the USA weekday on which fresh Toblerone hits Boston, Massachusetts, USA's Newbury Street's import confectioner's shelves, and the Saudi Minister of Home Entertainment's inability to control his appetites for Wednesday Toblerone often requires the medical attaché to remain in personal attendance all evening on the bulk-rented 14th floor of the Back Bay Hilton, juggling tongue depressors and cotton swabs, Nystadin and ibuprofen and styptics and antibiotic thrush salves, rehabilitating the mucous membranes of the dyspeptic and distressed, and often but not always penitent and appreciative Saudi Prince Q. So, on the 1st of April, YDAU, when the medical attaché is, it is alleged, insufficiently deft with a Q-tip on an ulcerated sinal necrosis, and is subjected at just 1,800 hours to a fit of febrile thrush of pique from the florally imbalanced Minister of Home Entertainment, and is by high-volume fiat replaced at the royal bedside by the prince's personal physician, who summoned by beeper from the Hilton sauna, and when the damp personal physician pats the medical attaché on the shoulder and tells him to pay the pique no mind, that it's just the yeast talking, but to just head on home and unwind and for once make a well-deserved early Wednesday evening of it. And but so when the attaché does get home at like 1840 hours, his spacious Boston apartments are empty, the living room lights undimmed, dinner unheated and the attachable tray still in the dishwasher, and worst, of course, no entertainment cartridges have been obtained from the Boylston Street Interlace outlet, where the medical attaché's wife, like all the veiled wives and companions of the prince's legatees, has a complimentary goodwill account. And even if he weren't far too exhausted and tightly wound to venture back into the damp urban night to pick up entertainment cartridges, the medical attaché realizes that his wife has, as always on Wednesdays, taken the car with the diplomatic immunity license plates, without which your thinking alien wouldn't even dream of trying to park publicly at night in Boston, Massachusetts, USA. The medical attaché's unwinding options are thus severely constricted. The living room's lavish TP receives also the spontaneous disseminations of the Interlace subscription pulse matrix. But the procedures for ordering specific spontaneous pulses from the service are so technologically and cryptographically complex that the attaché has always left the whole business to his wife. On this Wednesday night, trying buttons and abbreviations almost at random, the attaché is able to summon up only live USA professional sports, which he has always found brutish and repellent, Texaco Oil Company-sponsored opera, which the attaché has seen today more than enough of the human uvula, thank you very much, a re-disseminated episode of the popular afternoon Interlace children's program, Mr. Bouncity Bounce, which the attaché thinks for a moment might be a documentary on bipolar mood disorders, until he catches on and thumbs the selection panel hastily, and a re-disseminated session of the scantily clad variable impact early AM Fit Forever home aerobic series of the Interlace aerobics guru, Ms. Tony Kondo, the scantily clad and splay-limbed immodesty of which threatens the devout medical attaché with the possibility of impure thoughts. The only entertainment cartridges anywhere in the apartment, a foul-tempered search reveals, are those which have arrived in Wednesday's USA postal delivery, left on the sideboard in the living room, along with personal and professional faxes, and mail the medical attaché declines to read, until it's been pre-scanned by his wife for relevant interest to himself. The sideboard is against the wall opposite the room's electronic recliner under a triptych of high-quality Byzantine erotica. The padded cartridge mailers, with their distinctive rectangular bulge, are mixed haphazardly in with the less entertaining mail. Searching for something to unwind with, the medical attaché tears the different padded mailers open along their designated perforations. There is an ONANMA specialty service film on actinomycete class antibiotics and irritable bowel syndrome. There is the April 1st YDAU's CBC Pathé North American News Summary 40-minute cartridge, available daily by a wife's auto subscription, and either transmitted to TP by unrecordable interlace pulse, or express posted on a single-play ROM self-erasing disc. There is the Arabic language video edition of April's Self magazine for the attaché's wife. Nas's covers, model chastely swathed and veiled. There is a plain brown and irritatingly untitled cartridge case in a featureless white 3-day standard USA first-class padded cartridge mailer. The padded mailer is postmarked suburban Phoenix area in Arizona, USA, and the return address box has only the term, "Happy Anniversary," with a small, drawn, crude face, smiling, in ballpoint ink, instead of a return address or incorporated logo. Though by birth and residence a native of Quebec, where the language of discourse is not English, the medical attaché knows quite well that the English word anniversary does not mean the same as birthday. And the medical attaché and his veiled wife were united in the eyes of God and prophet not in April, but in October, 4 years prior, in the Rub al-Khali. Adding to the padded mailer's confusion is the fact that anything from Prince Q's legation in Phoenix, Arizona, USA, would carry a diplomatic seal instead of routine O-N-A-N postage. The medical attaché, in sum, feels tightly wound and badly underappreciated and is prepared in advance to be irritated by the item inside, which is merely a standard black entertainment cartridge but is wholly unlabeled and not in any sort of colorful or informative or inviting cartridge case, and has only another of these vapid USA-type circular smiling heads embossed upon it where the registration and duration codes are supposed to be embossed. The medical attaché is puzzled by the cryptic mailer and face and case and unlabeled entertainment, and preliminarily irritated by the amount of time he's had to spend upright at the sideboard attending to mail, which is not his task. The sole reason he does not throw the unlabeled cartridge in the waste can or put it aside for his wife to preview for relevance is because there are such woefully slim entertainment pickings on his wife's irritating, Americanized tennis league evening away from her place at home. The attaché will pop the cartridge in and scan just enough of its contents to determine whether it is irritating or of an irrelevant nature and not entertaining or engaging in any way. He will heat the prepared halal lamb and spicy halal garnish in the microwave oven until piping hot, arrange it attractively on his tray, preview the first few moments of the puzzling and or irritating or possibly mysteriously blank entertainment cartridge first, then unwind with the news summary. Then perhaps have a quick, unlibidinous look at Nas's spring line of sexless black devout women's wear. Then we'll insert the recursive Surf and Rain cartridge and make a well-deserved early Wednesday evening of it, hoping only that his wife will not return from her tennis league in her perspiration-dampened black ankle-length tennis ensemble and remove his dinner tray from his sleeping neck in a clumsy or undeft fashion that will awaken him, potentially. When he settles in with the tray and cartridge, the TP's viewer's digital display reads 1927 hours. Year of the Trial Size Dove Bar.
Well, Dean say her mama ain't treat her right. Reginald, he come round to my blacktop at my building where me and Dolores Epps jump double dutch, and he say, "Clinette, Waldine be down in my crib, cry say her mama ain't treat her right." And I go on with Reginald to his building where he live at, and Waldine be sit deep far back in a closet in Reginald's crib, and she be cry. Reginald gone lift Waldine out the closet, and me with him crying, and I be rub on the wet all over Waldine's face. And Reginald be so careful when he took off all her shirts she got on. Tell Waldine to let me see. Waldine back all beat up and cut up. Big stripes are cut all up and down Waldine back. Pink stripes and around the stripes of skin like the skin on folks' lips be like. Sick down in my insides to look at it. Waldine be cry. Reginald say Waldeen say her mama ain't treat her right. Say her mama beat Waldeen with a hanger. Say Waldeen mama, man, Roy, Tony, we want to lie down with Waldeen. We give Waldeen candy and fives. We stand in her way in Waldeen's face and he ain't let her pass without he all the time touching her. Reginald say Waldeen say Roy, Tony at night when Waldeen mama at work, he come into the mattresses where Waldeen and William and Chantel and Roy the baby sleep at, and he stand there in the dark, high, and say quiet things at her, and breathe. Waldeen mama say Waldeen tempt Roy Tony into sin. Waldeen say, she say Waldeen try to take away Roy Tony into evil and sin with her young tight self. She beat Waldeen back with hangers out the closet. My mama say Waldeen mama not right in her head. My mama scared of Roy Tony. Waldeen be cry. Reginald, he down and beg for Waldeen to tell Reginald mama how Waldeen mama treat Waldeen. Reginald say he love his Waldeen. Say he love but ain't never before this time could understand why Waldeen won't lie down with him like girls do their man. Say Waldeen ain't never let Reginald take off her shirts until tonight. She come to Reginald crib in his building and be cry. And she let Reginald take off her shirts to see how Waldeen mama beat Waldeen because Roy Tony. Reginald love his Waldeen. Waldeen be like to die scared. She say no to Reginald beg. She say if she go to Reginald mama, then Reginald mama go to Waldeen mama. Then Waldeen mama think Waldeen be lie down with Reginald. Waldeen say her mama say, Waldeen let a man lie down before she's 16 and she beat Waldeen to death. Reginald say he ain't no way gonna let that happen to Waldeen. Roy Tony killed Dolores Epps' brother, Columbus Epps, at the Brighton Projects 4 years gone. Roy Tony on parole. Waldeen say he show Waldeen he got something on his ankle, sent radio signals to parole that he's still here in Brighton. Roy Tony can't be leave Brighton. Roy Tony brother be Waldeen father. He gone. Reginald try to hush Waldeen, but he cannot stop Waldeen cry. Waldeen look like crazy, she's so scared. She say she kill herself if me or Reginald tell our mamas. She say, Clinette, you my half-sister. I am beg you that you do not tell your mama or my mama and Roy Tony. Reginald tell Waldeen to hush herself and lie down quiet. He put shed spread out the kitchen on Waldeen cuts on her back. He run his finger with grease so careful down pink lines of her getting beat with her hanger. Waldeen say she do not feel nothing on her back ever since spring. She lies stomach on Reginald's floor and say she ain't got no feeling in her skin of her back. When Reginald gone to get the water, she asked me the truth. How bad is her back look when Reginald look at it? Is she still pretty? She cry. I ain't tell my mama on Waldeen. And Reginald and Waldeen mama and Roy Tony. My mama scared of Roy Tony. My mama be the lady Roy Tony killed Columbus Epps over 4 years gone in the Brighton Projects for love. But I know Reginald tell. Reginald say he gonna die before Waldeen mama beat Waldeen again. He say he take himself up to Roy Tony and say him not to mess with Waldeen or breathe by her mattress at night. He say he take himself on down to the playground at the Brighton Projects where Roy Tony do business. And he go to Roy Tony man to man and he make Roy Tony make it all right. But I think Roy Tony gonna kill Reginald if Reginald go. I think Roy Tony gonna kill Reginald. And then Waldeen mama beat Waldeen to death with a hanger. And then nobody knows except me. And I'm gonna have a child.
In the 8th American educational grade, Bruce Green fell dreadfully in love with a classmate who had the unlikely name of Mildred Bonk. The name was unlikely because if ever an eighth grader looked like a Daphne Christensen or a Kimberly St. Simone or something like that, it was Mildred Bonk. She was the kind of fatally pretty and nubile wraith-like figure who glides through the sweaty junior high corridors of every nocturnal emitter's dreamscape. Hair that Green had heard described by an overwrought teacher as flaxen, a body which the fickle angel of puberty, the same angel who didn't even seem to know Bruce Green's zip code, had visited, kissed, and already left back in 6th.
legs which not even orange keds with purple glitter-encrusted laces could make unserious. Shy, iridescent, coltish, pelvically infractious, amply busted,